Hello, welcome to The Third Degree. This is Climate Justice Radio, and I'm Libby.
And I'm James.
And
today we are joined by a very special guest.
We have got a very special guest. Her name is Tessa Dowdle, and she's a climateer.
What's a climateer, Tessa? You just told us you're a climateer. I don't know.
It's
a bit like a planeteer.
A bit like a planeteer. I guess just a climate activist working to save the climate. You can be one too.
A hero.
Yes. We can all be one. And yeah, Tess is going to be talking to us about all the different things coming up that we can be climateers during. We've also got coming up an interview with Lee Rhiannon about the Gunnedah protests that are happening at the moment, and a follow-up story that Nick's doing about the Garneau report.
Nick did a story a few weeks ago about Garneau's interim targets, which were released. There's been a bit of back and forth between NGOs and Garneau since then, so Nick's going to be covering that.
Yes, he is, indeed. But before we do that, let's talk to our climateer of the week. Tessa, there's some interesting things happening at the moment. It's Climate Emergency Week. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, there was a week of action called for this week, the last week of September, because it's the spring equinox. So this is when we expect the Arctic to be at its lowest ice coverage. So the greatest melt will occur in this week of September. And actually, it's quite scary because a few weeks ago, the Arctic was circumnavigable for the first time. And that wasn't supposed to happen or predicted to happen until about 2070. So we are in a bit of a climate emergency.
So that means you can sail a ship from like the top of North America to Russia, basically. Like,
yes,
it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So climate emergency week. Who's kind of called this emergency week of action?
Well, it's kind of a joint initiative of climate action groups around Australia.
And what's a climate action group?
Climate action groups are community groups that have been set up in local areas, just regular people ready to take action on climate change and wanting to do something about it.
And what's the sort of thinking behind having all these little groups working and then sort of coming together for this rather than one big organising group?
Well, having decentralised local climate action groups means that it's a non-hierarchical system of action. So it's quite a diverse movement. People can engage quite easily within the movement through their local group. Really, also, it helps build community, which I think is really important with the current state we're in. Being isolated individuals, it helps lead to or reinforces despair in the face of climate change. But community action groups, taking action together, builds community and builds hope.
Yeah.
Now, as we are speaking here this morning, there's actually a bunch of people sandbagging Martin Place, I've been told. Do you know anything about what's happening down there?
Yeah, well, a few community grassroots groups have gotten together and formed a group called People for a Safe Climate. And they thought that they'd do a bit of a stunt for the week. So they dressed up as the Climate Emergency Service. They're wearing red T-shirts. So if you see them in Martin Place, say hello.
And it's not a real emergency down there. It's a stunt. You don't have to be worried.
It's a stunt, yes.
But there is a real emergency going on.
There is a real emergency going on,
yes.
So can you tell us what else is happening, you know, this week for Climate Emergency Week?
Well, People for a Safe Climate in Sydney are also organising for a rally at Xstrata, offices of one of the largest coal companies in Australia, at Macquarie Place on October the 2nd at 5 p.m. So that's kind of after Garneau is released, which is on the 30th. But also this week, there's a lot of stuff happening around the country, lots of rallies, etc. In Queensland in particular, they've been quite active. There's a group called Urban Parking that's been setting up grass spaces in car park spaces and having picnics and doing creative design courses and stuff like that. There's also, excitingly, on Monday, a group of students and community members walked into Kevin Rudd's office and did an office occupation as part of Climate Emergency Week and demanding better targets for a safe climate future.
Yeah, that was a bit exciting. Do you know how long they were in Kevin Rudd's office for?
I'm not sure, but it was a number of hours, and they refused to leave until they had arranged an interview with Kevin Rudd, who's actually in New York.
Do we know if they had they have arranged an interview for the future with Kevin Rudd?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, we'll find out from them next week, hopefully.
That would be exciting to actually get to talk to Kevin Rudd about some of these things. Are there more things planned in the future? More actions and sit-ins and things like this coming up?
There is. There'll be a series of actions throughout early November to put pressure on the government to put out stronger targets in the white paper than GANU has suggested. And then, excitingly, in December, as a response to the white paper that's going to be released about the carbon pollution reduction scheme, there will be sit-ins in hopefully every MP's office across Australia.
Sit-ins in every MP's office.
That's the aim.
In Australia.
But targeting specifically big players that people are very, very prominent in the public sphere.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
That is pretty big and exciting.
So can you tell me what a sit-in involves? Because I've heard of them, but I haven't really, don't know too much about them.
Yeah, a sit-in is a form of non-violent protest where you can go into an office, like an industrial office or a political office, and disrupt work for a certain number of period of time. So you can just grab a bunch of friends, go in, stall the stuff. It'd be good to have a theme. So, for instance, if you're in Martin Fergus's electorate, which is Batman, you could play a bit of fun there. Or if you're in Peter Garrett's electorate, how can we sleep while the planet is burning? It's good to have a theme so people don't get bored, and also to define when you want to leave. Like if you want to say for a set period of time, like 120 minutes, 12 months till Copenhagen, which is the next round of Kyoto-like negotiations. Or you could say we're not going to leave until we're removed, etc.
I guess, like, it's interesting to think about sit-ins as a tactic or whatever for asking for change. How do you think all these different tactics sort of work together, like, and what's effective about a sit-in compared to, say, a protest?
Well, different types of tactics are all different ways for engaging different types of people. Like, a sit-in might appeal to a certain type of person, or someone might want to rock up to a rally, or someone might want to be quite proactive and on the edge and do some culture jamming and change the environment that they live in. So they all, and they also target different audiences as well, like a culture jamming. You'll get walkers-by, passers-by, and with sit-ins, you'll probably get a lot of national mainstream media, etc.
How do workers react to the people coming into their office? I mean, do you bring them, like, you know, cupcakes, and do you hang out? Because if you're aiming to distract them, I guess you could distract them in quite a fun way if you really wanted to.
Yeah, I think it's really important to do it in a fun way, and that makes it less confrontational. And more enjoyable.
Maybe you should just sign them all up for Facebook and they'll be distracted for good.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we talked about Garneau's interim targets in there and his paper, which is going to be released last week, which sounds like a good opportunity.
Yeah.
To Frodo, what's been happening over the last couple of weeks with GANU?
Well, yeah, Nick did a story a couple of weeks ago on GANU, and I guess some of the outrage that different groups have been sort of expressing in relation to that. And in response to that, apparently GANU sent Green Groups a letter.
He has, yes. And a number of those groups, including WWF and ACF, I believe, have sent replies back, including Friends of the Earth and in a joint letter with a number of climate action groups. So Nick spoke to Damien Lawson, Climate Justice Coordinator from Friends of the Earth Australia, about GANU's letter to him and the back and forth which has been going on.
Is GANU on the defensive or simply going about the job of gathering information for the government?
Oh, look, I think Professor GANU was probably surprised by the level of criticism that his interim report on what targets Australia should set for its cuts to carbon pollution. And in a sense, his response to the scientists in particular was a sign that I suppose he knows that what he's advocating can't be sustained on any scientific basis. I mean, when you actually look at his report, what he's been saying all the way along from his first interim report where he sets out the real costs and dangers of climate change, and then in this second interim report which sets out the targets for pollution cuts, he's actually outlined what catastrophic changes we're facing and what levels of cuts that actually need to be put in place to prevent that. But then he's gone another step further and he said, even though I've said this, I actually think we should be setting our cuts at a much lower level, because he's pessimistic about the prospects of getting a global agreement to implement, you know, global cuts. What we're saying to him is that you know, that's not your job to decide on the politics. Your job is to outline the scientific case and, in economic terms, the costs and benefits of acting or not acting on climate change. And he's done that, and he's done that reasonably well. But then he's gone the next step and sort of advised the government, even though I've said this, even though I've said it's going to be really bad unless we make big cuts, I'm saying to you we shouldn't be making those big cuts.
Yeah, and in the letter you're saying that middle-of-the-road outcomes are unlikely and much worse outcomes are likely. Considering the input that you guys have just sent off to Garneau, do you expect that we'll see dramatic changes in his next submission to government?
Look, we hope so. We hope that his final report emphasises what he calls the bad possibilities, which really are the real catastrophic changes. You know, the destruction of the Amazon, the permafrost bomb, the mass, you know, really large sea level rises, you know, huge displacement of people. Those what he calls the bad possibilities, and he sort of, in his verbal statements, and said there's about 10% chance of that happening. We hope that he emphasises the government that those possibilities are far more likely than what he has said so far. And every week, new scientific evidence comes out that we're on track for those worst possibilities. And if that's the case, then at the very least, and this is what we're putting very strongly in this statement, at the very least, he needs to be saying to government, you need to be looking at a target of 300 to 325 parts per million rather than this 450 target. At the very least, they'd need to be doing the modelling of how we would actually get there in economic terms and in structural terms. Because otherwise, really, our policy is immoral. And this is the other point we make in the letter. You know, like, what cost do we put on the loss, you know, the displacement of a billion people who rely on the seven rivers that are fed by the Himalaya ice sheet, which with a 450 target is inevitably going to go?
Sure, and considering Australia's ratification of Kyoto and playing a part in Bali and everything, how much of a surprise was Garneau's call to wait for international agreement?
Oh, look, to some degree it wasn't a surprise, but it was a real disappointment, and it's a reflection of what a difficult task we have to convince our leaders and our policymakers that they need to be taking much stronger action, and in particular not waiting for a global agreement. We have a real responsibility to do that because of our historical emissions and because of our role in exporting coal. We're the biggest coal exporter, and I suppose it just highlights the need to continue to develop, you know, a community movement that is putting a really strong case for action on climate change, and climate action groups are really crucial to that. I'd really encourage any of your listeners, if you're not part of a climate action group, join the one that's in your suburb. If you don't have one in your suburb, get one started and get active.
Sure, and just finally, in the letter you reference, Al Gore, who addressed America in July, calling for them to commit to producing 100% of their electricity from renewable energy and truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years. And you're urging Professor Garneau to advocate for this or such a transformative agenda. But if such a goal were to be hampered by politics, do you think he's likely to do that?
Well, look, he's probably not likely to do that, but, you know, we're hopeful that he does advocate that sort of transformative agenda. I mean, the reality is that's what we need, you know, and we need to be recognising that this is an emergency situation, and in an emergency situation, you make what's threatening you the number one priority for all your effort, your economic and societal effort. The analogy really is the Second World War, and this is the analogy Al Gore's been using as well. In the Second World War, America, and indeed Australia, put about 40% of the economy's wealth into fighting the Second World War, 40% of GDP. Professor Garneau is only advocating, you know, about 1% of GDP be put into the effort of challenge, you know, dealing with climate change. And the great thing about Al Gore's call is that he has highlighted how simple, in one sense, the solution to the problem is. You know, like, as once you make a decision that certain special interests, like the coal industry, should not hold a country to ransom and hold our climate policy to ransom, the process of moving to solar thermal, to wind, to geothermal, transforming our electricity industry, can actually be done really quickly.
was Nick speaking to Damien Lawson.
From Friends of the Earth Australia. So Garno's actual report comes out next week. And the white paper report, when does that come out, Tessa? It's December.
Yeah, sometime in December. It hasn't been announced yet.
Mm. And so when's the best time for people to, I guess, voice their concern about the white paper? Obviously, they can submit submissions. But if they wanted to, you know, do some kind of proactive demonstration of their opinions, as we've talked about earlier, yeah, when's the best time for those kind of things to happen?
I think from now on, so especially focusing around when the Gardner Report is released on the 30th, and then from then on till about the start of November, to really keep the pressure up on politicians to make a good submission to the white paper.
Yeah, so I guess coal is pretty bad. We often talk about how we don't like coal on this show. What sort of things are being done across the country to campaign against coal? I know there's a lot of interesting things going on.
Yep. Well, we're targeting coal because it's responsible, burning coal to make electricity is responsible for about 40% of global carbon emissions. And in Australia, it's responsible for about 50% of our own domestic emissions. So we're trying to achieve a culture shift, which
Yay.
Is...
A coal culture shift?
Yes, a coal culture shift.
This is a very punny show, Tessa, so you're definitely a very good guest to have on.
Oh, great, because I have a great opening sentence from people who are involved in culture shift, which has three puns. Because people involved in culture shift are a coalition of people collaborating to catalyse a culture shift in Australia, which is the largest exporting country in the world, to move to a moratorium on coal and a rapid shift to renewable energy.
Oh, that's just the kind of culture shift I'd love to see. And is there going to be some culture jamming happening, Tessa?
Yes, there will be some culture jamming happening this week, actually, in Climate Emergency Week. So if you're walking around, just have a little bit of a closer look to all those advertisements you see.
And so just quickly, what is culture jamming, or as we've said here a number of times, culture jamming, for those who haven't really heard of it?
Okay, well, regular culture jamming is like subverting advertising that's in the streets and in everyday life. We receive about... you know, thousands of advertising messages a day. So culture jamming aims to bend the messages that we receive to more positive...
reveal the truth a little bit more,
yeah,
I guess. Yeah.
And culture jamming is specifically targeting greenwashing and changing things to have more of a climate theme or like spotlighting... like major greenhouse polluters.
So I guess if anyone has any ideas, if they've seen any things out there that like BP saying how great and green they are, or other polluting companies saying what wonderful things they're doing for the environment, send any suggestions of something you'd like to see jammed.
Any advertisements around town?
Yeah.
Let us know. We'll put them on our website, and then people like Tessa can hypothetically view them.
Yeah, or if you want to just go off and do a bit of jamming on your own, you should, and send us pictures of what you've jammed.
So email us at climateradio@gmail.com, or you can also visit our website, which is climateradio.blogspot.com.
Yay!
But now we're moving on to, I guess, more protests which have been happening in New South Wales around coal, aren't we, Libby?
Yep, back onto coal and onto other dirty polluting companies. Back to Gunnedah, where we've done a couple of stories on Gunnedah, where BHP has been doing a lot of coal exploration, and there's been a big rally and protest that happened there.
At the Gunnedah Coal Conference, which I think has been happening for a few days up there earlier this week.
Yeah, so there was a big protest that happened on the Tuesday outside the conference, and Robin King spoke to Lee Rhiannon of the Greens, who went along to support the protesters there.
I've just come from an excellent rally in Gunnedah. There was probably getting up to 400 people, 300 to 400 people we had there, and it was a real show of strength between farmers, other locals, Greens, environmentalists, And I think this will be critical to the campaign, building that alliance amongst different groupings. So I was really pleased with the outcome, and certainly many of the locals said that they thought that was a real show of strength in support of this land being left for agricultural purposes, not being destroyed by mining.
So the rallies moved off the blockade on the farm to actually protesting in the town?
Yes, yes, it was a big protest in Gunnedah. The blockade out at the Duddy's property is still continuing. We were out there yesterday, and that's been going for 7 weeks now, which is really impressive. And there's a big roster of people across the district who come in each day and make sure that that area is staffed. So BHP Billiton is not able to go onto the Duddy's property, which is the Rosmar estate, and start exploring for coal.
And how long do you think they can continue with the blockade?
Oh, look, they are highly committed. You can see that they are going to stay there till they win. And that's really important. One of the comments I made when I spoke at the rally today, that this campaign is really appreciated by people far away from this district, because we need to preserve all the agricultural land we have. So it's not just about this local land for the farmers in this district, it's about saving agricultural land for Australia and indeed the world. We need all the agricultural land that we have at the moment.
The Greens, you're opposed to any new coal mines anywhere in Australia, aren't you?
Yes, so the Greens' policy is no new coal mines. I have been concerned at times that our position has been distorted, that we want to close down the industry. That's not what we're saying. We have an excellent policy, which is about a transition to the clean energy of renewables and energy efficiency. So there's no need to run out of energy. We need a responsible government that plans for that transition away from coal, and that's the way we could plan for having no new coal mines.
And is it up to the state government to say whether or not BHP Billiton can mine that land?
Yes, it's the state government that has enormous power in this, and they have the say on the opening up of new coal mines. And in the first instance, the decision is with the planning minister. And one of the issues we discussed at the rally today, some of the speakers brought up, is how unfair the planning laws are. The planning laws have been changed in recent years, and the possibility for the community to have a say has been weakened enormously by the amendments that have gone through. And unfortunately, Labor and the Coalition voted together to support these amendments that really do lock the community out of having an input on these big projects. And the decision is up to the minister. The minister can make the decision with no input, even from their Director General. So it's quite extraordinary. There is a new Planning Minister, Christine Keneally. The Greens were surprised that the new Premier, Mr Rees, did put her into the job, because, like her predecessor, Frank Sartor, she's also been tainted with developer donations. She's taken tens of thousands of dollars in donations from developers, and many of these developers are the same people who then have their projects approved by the minister. So we do think it was an unwise choice.
And you haven't spoken, or the farmers or people involved haven't spoken to Ms Keneally?
No, we haven't had the opportunity yet. Another issue that we discussed at the rally today in terms of keeping the campaign going was many of the locals are thinking of coming to Macquarie Street to have a protest there and to ask for a series of meetings with the Minister for Planning, the Minister for Water, the Minister for Mining. And the Labor government would be wise to grant those meetings. What we've seen up to date is Mr Sartor and Mr McDonald, Mr Sartor, the previous Minister for Planning, and Mr McDonald, the Minister for Mining, regularly refused to meet with communities in this situation. Now, if Premier Rees tries to make out he's got a new government, well, if he wants to pretend that's the case, they should get real and actually change their ways of working, and a good place would be to grant these meetings.
I guess Mr McDonald's a bit confused because he's also the Primary Industries Minister, isn't he?
Oh, yes. Look, I find that this is an issue that does make people very angry, that they understand that Mr McDonald, with responsibilities for primary industries and mining, is often deeply compromised, and so often he gives the backing to the mining industry well before he even looks at the needs of farming communities.
So this protest up here at Gunnedah, the local people involved, I guess they're more interested in their own specific area. Why are they opposed to this mine in particular?
They're certainly interested in their own area, and that's understandable. Many of them are sixth and seventh generation farmers, so they have a deep commitment to the land. But I do believe, and I've now had a number of meetings with the locals on visits to the area, and as well as when they come to Sydney, is that they understand the importance of this area to the needs of the whole nation of Australia. It's this huge, rich agricultural land where the drought rarely impacts on it because of these incredible aquifer systems, so there's a regular supply of water. The soil is very fertile, so the productivity is high. So they recognise that they actually have a responsibility to safeguard this land for the benefit of future generations, not just here, but further afield.
And that was Robin King speaking to Greens MP Lee Rhiannon.
So it's getting close to the end of the show this week, and we've talked a lot about protests, and a lot of people here probably, you know, haven't been involved in a lot of these things, and maybe feeling a bit passionate after this inspiring show, Tessa. Can you tell us how, you know, somebody who hasn't been involved in these sorts of things can possibly get involved over the next couple of months?
Yeah, well, there's literally hundreds of climate action groups across Australia. There'll be one for sure in your community. So I'd probably recommend going to climatemovement.org, and that has a list of all the climate action groups in Australia. And so that has the contact details as well, so you can just call up someone from your local climate action group or go along to a meeting and meet people and get involved. Or you can just grab a bunch of friends and start getting active on climate change together.
And there's a whole lot of different events coming up that people can get involved in as well if they want to be more involved.
Mm. Can you tell us about the climate emergency rally details again?
Yeah, well, there's going to be a rally at Xstrata head offices, which are at 1 Macquarie Place in Sydney, near the Rocks. It's on October the 2nd at 5 p.m, and we're asking people to bring red flashing bike lights, bit of an emergency theme there. And there'll also be a speaker from Gunnedah as well, so you can meet these people in person.
Mm.
Oh, cool.
And Libby, you're also doing something later today at Sydney Uni, aren't you?
Yes, I am. It's been the Enviro Week, happening all week at Sydney University, and there's a few different things still to come today and tomorrow. At 11 a.m, I will be joining a couple of people to have a bit of a discussion about indie media and just hear different people's experiences of that. We'll be speaking to a zine maker and a filmmaker, and anyone can come along to that. Then at 1 p.m. there's a bike scavenger hunt where people can, you know, have fun and maybe win a prize. Then at 1:30 we've got a afternoon tea picnic extravaganza with lots of zine making, screen printing, badge making, bike riding, knitting, etc., etc., etc. And at 3 p.m. there's the forum on renewable energy solutions, looking at successful and often overlooked possibilities. Then it all finishes up with the big veggie sock party for the year, happening at Herman's Bar on Friday evening from about 7 p.m.
Mm, sounds Woo-hoo. Great. And yep. All those details are currently on our website right now, which is climateradio.blogspot.com. So if you want to head along to any of those, visit our website. You can also hear previous podcasts.
Yes, you can.
And if you do want to get involved in any actions over the next month, feel free to drop us an email and we can help put you in touch with the right people for you as well at climateradio@gmail.com.
And that's about all we have time for this week. Thanks very much, Tessa.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you're on 2SER 107.3.